Hello and welcome to the Science Bloggers Podcast. I am David Latchman and today my guest is Ewan Somerville. Ewan is a postdoc scientist who is looking at ways to diagnose metabolic and mitochondrial diseases. He is also new to the world of science communication and science blogging, and he walks us through that journey as a science communicator. So, hi, Ewan, how are you?
I am good, thanks. How are you?
Why don't you tell our listeners about yourself and what you do?
Okay, so my name's Ewan. I'm a science writer and blogger. I've previously worked in research doing my PhD and postdocs. So my field has very much been in genetics, mostly focused on diagnosing a rare disease called mitochondrial disease in adults and children using the latest next generation sequencing technologies. And my real passion has been to write, which is why I started my own science blog about 6 months ago. And I spent a lot of time focusing on that recently.
Okay, you said you do something with metabolic and mitochondrial diseases. What exactly is that?
So mitochondrial disease is a very clinically heterogeneous disease. It can affect anyone at any time during their lives. That includes children, little babies, just even before birth. You can see onset of mitochondrial disease, or you can have adults very late in their life presenting with a somewhat very mild form of mitochondrial disease. And the basis of this is dysfunction of the mitochondria, which are found in almost every cell in our body. And a lot of the dysfunction associated with mitochondrial disease can be caused by pathogenic variants in the mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondria each carry multiple copies of mitochondrial DNA. So a damaging mutation in mitochondrial DNA can cause mitochondrial disease, and that can be passed on from mother to child, since mitochondria are passed down maternally. Or mitochondrial disease could be Mendelian, so you could have mitochondrial disease caused by inheriting one bad nuclear gene mutation from your mother and another from your father. And the clinical presentations of mitochondrial disease can be very catastrophic. So ranging from catastrophic fatal disorders all the way to a very mild disease course with perhaps a little muscle weakness or paralysis of the eye muscles. It's a very broad disorder.
So how exactly do you diagnose some of these diseases and treat it?
So mitochondrial disease can be a very tissue-specific disorder. Of course, mitochondria are required for energy production. So tissues that require a lot of energy, so that includes your heart, muscle, brain, these have a lot of mitochondria. And when someone has mitochondrial disease, these tissues packed with full of mitochondria can be affected more than others. So there are a plethora of diagnostic tools that can be used to diagnose mitochondrial disorders if such a disorder is suspected. One particularly important diagnostic tool is a muscle biopsy, which can be usually taken from around the thigh muscle. So diagnostic tests can analyze the biochemical activities in mitochondria. So looking at whether activities of the oxidative phosphorylation system, so this is the system that's required to make the energy that you need, so looking to see if the enzymes required for that are working properly. You can also look at a section of the muscle. So you can take lots of very thin slices of skeletal muscle, and you can look at the protein levels of proteins which are found in mitochondria. And you can detect mitochondrial dysfunction if the protein levels of these certain proteins are quite low. Typically, the proteins that we look at they're of the subunits that make up this oxidative phosphorylation system required for making energy. So mitochondrial disease is very difficult to diagnose based on simply just the clinical features. There's a lot of mimicking of other metabolic disorders, and that's where muscle biopsy can really help with the diagnosis.
You know, I was looking at your blog, and one of the articles you interviewed a fellow postdoc. I think her name was Dr. Amy Vincent. She was using an electron microscope to diagnose some of these diseases.
So electron microscopy, it's not an area that I know so well, but it's not necessarily a diagnostic tool, or at least not at this stage. So if I can recall correctly, Amy's work looks at the morphology of the mitochondria, and her work looks at comparing the morphology of someone who is of similar age, who is healthy, who doesn't have mitochondrial disease, and just compares the shape of mitochondria. In a nutshell, that's what that work with electron microscopy.
So her work was more to find out what the disease looks like compared to a healthy person.
Yeah. So a lot of the research in mitochondrial disease, especially where I was working, was trying to understand the underlying biological mechanisms. So what are the mechanisms associated with a mitochondrial DNA mutation? And Dr. Vincent's particular work was looking at the shape of mitochondria. So mitochondria, they're very dynamic organelles. So they're never, if you looked in a textbook, the classic figure you'd see of a mitochondria is this single ovoid shaped cell. But that's by far, that couldn't be further from what we see in skeletal muscle or when you perform immunofluorescence work. They're very dynamic. They're always connected. They form this very, they form a sort of network, and that's to transport. So a number of proteins required for mitochondria in mitochondrial function are transferred between mitochondria, and mitochondrial DNA itself is also transferred between mitochondria. And so if you have dysfunction of mitochondria, it's possible that one mechanism is that there is not enough fusion of these mitochondria, and therefore the movement of certain proteins in mitochondrial DNA may be underlying the pathogenesis of the disorder.
So what sort of treatment is available today for people with some of these disorders?
Unfortunately, there's very few therapeutic treatments for mitochondrial disease. I'm aware of that there are a number of trials using known compounds to see if those have an effect on mitochondrial function. But really, at the minute, currently, there really isn't any cure or any treatment. So there are certain measures that could be taken. So, for example, adults who have a mitochondrial disorder called progressive external ophthalmoplegia. It's a mitochondrial disorder characterized by a paralysis of the eye muscles. So it's a very subtle disorder where some patients may not even know they have this lack of eye movement. One symptom they may also have is drooping of the eyelids, because the eyelid muscles are so weak because of mitochondrial dysfunction. It's possible to have corrective surgery to raise those eyelids, but it's something that, through passage of time, it's not a permanent treatment at all. And there's patients who have multiple corrective surgery for that, as an example.
I see. Well, I guess that's why, you know, research is so important to help understand some of these, you know, disorders, and eventually will lead to a treatment for what some people have.
Yes, of course.
So what got you interested in science communication?
My real interest in science communication really started with writing manuscripts. I was always excited to with the processor sitting down to draft a manuscript, prepare an outline, prepare the figures for publication. But one thing that I never really got to do was to write anything other than manuscripts. And for me, I was keen to bridge the divide between scientists, who are almost certainly going to be the majority of people who end up reading the research articles that I'm writing, but there's nothing really there for the public or the wider public. And so I was keen to start my own science blog as a way of trying to communicate some aspects of science which are not necessarily talked about or not necessarily conveyed as well or as frequently as they should be.
From your blog, you also seem to talk about the learning process behind getting your blog up and running, monitoring traffic levels. You've talked about this mistake you made with Google Analytics, right? Where you had two plugins.
That was a very amateur mistake. I'm certainly not a... I certainly don't have a background in designing websites, making websites, and setting those up correctly. So it's a very... You don't learn without making mistakes. And that was a bit of an unfortunate mistake, unfortunately. I installed the Google Analytics plugin twice to monitor traffic. And because it was installed twice, I was receiving twice as many... So for every page view, it was recorded as two page views. So I actually thought I was getting double the traffic I was actually receiving. So that was funny, but a little sad at the same time.
It looks like a funny mistake, but it also illustrates that for science communicators, especially when they do it on their own, there's a certain level of technical expertise that's needed. You have to set up your web page, you have to set up your blog. You have to use the right plugins. You have to configure it correctly so that you know how you're doing, as opposed to just getting your message out there. You have to monitor how it's getting out there.
Yes, that's right. As a blogger, I've found a lot of my help and expertise with setting up my own website from other bloggers, not necessarily science bloggers, but bloggers who are expert in social media and digital marketing and search engine optimization. A lot of the help and suggestions I've received are from the excellent blog posts from bloggers with that expertise.
As a science communicator, what more things would you like to see as far as the technical aspects of communication is concerned?
I'm worried that there's a sort of a kind of a black box when it comes to, especially around the science publication process. So I don't think we convey very well how research goes from in the lab, data in a spreadsheet or an image on a computer screen, all the way up to a published manuscript. I firstly don't think that's been done very well. And I think that's something that can be improved on.
That is a problem that we definitely have to work on. How long have you been blogging?
I've only been blogging for about 6 months now. I'm still very early in my blogging life.
Do you have any idea who your intended audience is?
I would say I'm still trying to attract both scientists and non-scientists. I've written a number of lab hacks, so giving some of my own insight from my experience in a research lab to other scientists. So, for example, how to design the perfect sequencing primers, how to test secondary antibodies for a Western blot. But I've also written blog posts that are intended for a non-scientist. Or, for example, I've written, from my view, what the best steps are for somebody who's wanting to start a career in science. I'm planning a new blog post as well about how to read a scientific paper for non-scientists. I would say at this stage, I'm very much trying to find my feet with... who my readership is.
Yeah, it takes some time to figure out, who you are and, what you want to say. So I guess that's all part of the process, you know. But it looks like from your blog, right, you also talk about some personal experiences. So, you know, as we talk right now, Hurricane Florence is approaching and is predicted to hit the Carolinas here in the U.S. And in your blog, you also talk about your experiences with Hurricane Harvey. So do you want to talk about this? What it was like?
Oh, yeah. Of course, yeah. I've been completely obsessed with following the National Hurricane Center in the States. I've been obsessed with following their website over the past year now. I moved to Houston in July last year, and I was unfortunate enough to come at a time when there was a very active hurricane season. I distinctly remember watching the news during that time, just seeing this tropical depression meandering through the Gulf of Mexico, and the warnings just getting progressively and progressively alarming as the hurricane grew in strength and approached Houston. So that was a very interesting time in my life. I've never in my life had to stock up on food, on batteries. I had a box of ice in my kitchen as well, just in case we lost power and I wouldn't be able to keep any perishable food. There was a point where I was considering whether I needed to fill up my bath full of water in case we lost a clean water supply. Being from the UK, I'm very much used to wet weather, so I wasn't expecting anything more than just a heavy downpour. But the rainfall down in Houston was absolutely incredible. Just hearing it all banging on the windows overnight, just for four or five days relentlessly. I was lucky myself that I wasn't living near any bodies of water. So Houston's famous for its bayous. Thankfully, I was in a part of the city that was away from that. But there were many other people living in those areas in apartments on the first floor who were unlucky enough. The water really, it was a heck of a lot of rain. I was very fortunate myself, but going to Buffalo Bayou, just by downtown, was very sobering. Just the amount of sand that sifted and moved by the speed and volume of water was quite something.
You know, because when I was reading your article, well, I'm from the Caribbean. I'm from Trinidad, so it's like the southernmost island in the Caribbean. The way it's positioned, it's just outside of that hurricane zone. So for those of you that are listening who don't know, most hurricanes form off the coast of Africa, and they make this like northwesterly path upwards. And so we are just on that edge where most hurricanes strike. So it doesn't happen often, but it happens sometimes. And I do remember as a child, you know, some of the things that you talked about is like, oh, we have to hit the groceries, we have to stock up on food. Mm-hmm. You know, it brought a lot of that back, you know. And, you know, I don't think people realize like how dangerous, you know, a hurricane can be until, you know, they experience it. And, you know, I'm sure that's something you realized while you were in Houston.
Mm-hmm. You know. It was one of the uplifting things was seeing the city come together at the time, and the aftermath of the hurricane, and really helping those who had lost their homes or had been displaced, they've had to live in shelters, and who had really lost everything. It was one of the more uplifting aspects was seeing just how people in the city came together in the aftermath of such a disaster.
I've seen the images on your blog. I've also seen like some of my friends who also live in Houston. They posted pictures on social media as well. And, you know, the devastation, you know, the flooding was just, you know, it was shocking. And if I remember correctly, that was a Category 4 hurricane, was it?
Yes, I think so. If I remember right, it was Category 4.
it wasn't like the worst of the worst as hurricanes can go, but it was still, you know, pretty bad.
I think the real damage that came about from Harvey was the fact that it made landfall and really just stopped, completely stalled over the Texas coast. And that's really where the incredible amount of rain came from.
I think, yeah, that was one of the surprising things about that hurricane, because, you know, once it goes on landfall, you expect it to like just keep moving straight up. And then it loses power because it doesn't have that warm ocean water to get energy from. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every hurricane is different, so you don't always know what to expect. As far as science communication, where do you see yourself going? Where would you like to go with it?
I'd very much like to stick with writing with my blog. But I think, like many new starters with a blog, it's difficult finding the time to write good content, and that's something I've not done enough of so far. So I'd like to try and focus more on that, maybe try and post once a week. I would very much like to eventually become a science writer, a science communicator as a full-time career, whether that's working for somebody or working for myself. But I think I'm really at the stage where I'm not quite there yet. I'm still trying to work full time and use my blog as a hobby or a kind of a side hustle at the minute.
As far as the group goes, the Science Bloggers group goes, what more content would you like to see that you think will help you as a science communicator?
I mean, the content that's been posted on the Science Bloggers group so far has been great. I think it would be awesome for other bloggers to share their experiences of the writing process and the process of how their blog's doing, kind of a behind the scenes look at that. That's something I tried to do on my first and second month, just give an update of where the traffic is at, what my blogging plans are, what my goals and targets are for my blog for the following month. Admittedly, I haven't done that for about 3 or 4 months, but I think it's something that, you know, providing an update on how the cogs are turning is something I think every science blogger should do. I think it would certainly help new bloggers as well who want to set up their own blog.
Hopefully we'll try to implement some of those ideas so it becomes an educational resource in the future for, you know, people to use, both the more experienced members and any newcomers. So they know, like, I can turn to this, and if I have any questions, you know, I can find answers.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
So as we wrap up this, is there anything you'd like to add or to say about anything in general?
I just hope listeners will visit my blog. If there's anything that they'd love to see, I'm very much keen to write about it. My ears are open. I'm ready to listen out and see what my readers are looking for.
Okay. I'll be sure to leave a link to in the show notes so people can find you and contact you.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
And that was Ewan Somerville. If you'd like to check out Ewan's blog, you can check it out at ewansomerville.com. And if you have anything you'd like to see on his blog, you should contact him and give him some suggestions. The Science Bloggers is a community of science bloggers, YouTubers, and podcasters. If you're a science communicator, you should check out our Facebook group. If you're a fan of science blogs and science content, feel free to check out our Facebook page. I'm your host, David Latchman, and I would like to thank you for joining us. If you liked this episode, please consider subscribing or leaving a comment below. Tell us what you think and what you'd like to see in future episodes. And I hope to see you next week, when we talk to a new science communicator.